What is the risk of moral injury to frontline healthcare workers? To explore this question, I'm joined by Monique Jonas and Philippa Malpas. Monique is an ethical theorist who specialises in healthcare ethics, distributive justice, and a number of other ethical topics. And Philippa Malpas is a medical ethicist and teacher in medical humanities. Welcome to you both.
Kia ora. Thank you for having us, Lil.
So firstly, just acknowledging this extraordinary time of these world events amidst COVID-19 and the work that our essential workers are doing. Firstly, I wanted to ask you, what is moral injury and how does this differ from the term moral distress?
Shall I tackle that one, Philippa?
Yeah, go for it, Monique.
I'll get the ball rolling then. We can think about moral distress as being the state that we experience when we have a sense of what action we should take. So it's unlike a moral dilemma. And when you're in a moral dilemma, you're not sure about how you should act. There seems like there's no good action or no action that satisfies all the ethical constraints that you see. When you experience moral distress, you know you have a sense of what action you should take, but you are constrained from taking that action. And it might be because of external constraints like a policy that makes it impossible for you to take the action that you believe you should take, or it could be to do with internal factors. So distress is that the affect that accompanies that judgment that we reach, that the action that we can take is wrong. So that we can think about that as being distress. And I guess that moral injury is like the sequelae of that, if you like. It's what we are left with when we are in a situation that is so morally distressing that it leaves us with some kind of permanent scar. And so it could be an injury that results from an awareness that an action that we have taken is wrong, deeply wrong, like wrong in an identity affecting way, not just wrong like I didn't give that person the right change at a shop, but affecting who you are either as a professional or as a person. Or it could be an injury that results from you being in a situation, being party to a situation that is deeply wrongful, where something wrong occurs. It might not be you that did it, but you're party to that and you don't prevent that wrong from happening.
Sorry, go ahead, Philippa.
So I was going to say, yeah, I think often moral distress and moral injury are sometimes seen as one and the same thing, but I think Monique's made a really good distinction there. And I think moral suffering kind of can be thought of as like an umbrella term that sits over both of these, and that the difference between them really is that distress is a necessary condition for experiencing the injury, the moral injury. And certainly in the literature, a lot of the work that's been done in moral injury has been around veterans, the police, people who are experiencing really traumatic situations that can often lead to an altering kind of their beliefs, actually, their deeply held moral beliefs and expectations.
And that distress can be at many levels, mental, emotional and spiritual. And there's that link that you have made with those beliefs and values which are deeply held by people. How does failing to act in ways that transgress moral beliefs differ from making ethical decisions?
So when we're faced with an ethical decision or an ethical dilemma, often we're faced with a number of ways of acting. And we might have good reasons to think that we could act in any number of ways. And so we might put forward those reasons, we might have discussions with others, we might think about the reasons for acting in certain kinds of way and come to a conclusion that I am justified ethically in acting this particular way, and these are my reasons. And people don't necessarily do that in any kind of formal way, but often that's how our thinking would work. We put forward the reasons for acting in certain kinds of ways. One of the challenges with moral distress in the particular climate that we're talking about is that healthcare workers in many instances will know what the right thing to do is, but be constrained from acting in that way because of the constraints that have been put in place. And in this case, it's around physical distancing. So some of the things that we may want to do to fulfil the kinds of healthcare roles that we have, we're simply unable to do. And that's across a whole lot of different situations. And an obvious one would be, you know, being able to comfort somebody who needs that because we can't physically touch other people, something that is part and parcel, I think, of care, caring for others.
What conditions and constraints are health professionals working under at this current time?
Oh, there's so many, aren't there? So, I mean, the points that Philippa has made about physical distancing and the impact that's had on healthcare workers in particular, I think that's really interesting to think through because that affects the way that professionals express their role with patients, and it doesn't only affect how they connect with or have to isolate themselves from their patients and whānau, but it also affects the constraints that they place on families. So families who may wish to be with a loved one who's dying may be prevented from doing that, and that is going to be very distressing for health professionals who don't usually have to maintain standards like that or conditions like that. So there are those kinds of requirements enforcing social distancing in situations where patients need more than ever to have the people who they love and trust around them. And then, of course, there's all the resource constraints, the constraints around who can have access to essential services like ventilation, oxygen, and how they distribute the means of protecting their own colleagues. So around the PPE, which has become a term that we're suddenly all familiar with. So those are some of the, so I mean, and that just gives you a sense, doesn't it, of how all-encompassing the changes are for health professionals. So they're having to make a whole lot of decisions and implement a whole lot of circumstances or conditions that really extend them beyond the way that they normally do their job. So there's the individual changes, but there's also just, you know, the collective burden that places on health professionals.
I was thinking about some of the questions that some of my colleagues might be having to ask themselves in other countries, like, whose life shall we save? How can we save the most lives? Who will benefit most? Who will receive ventilatory support? And who will have a better outcome? How do we choose? Philippa, you were going to say something.
That's such an important question, and let's not let's come back to that. I was just, you know, one of the things that I found really haunting over the last few days has been seeing some of the footage coming out of New York, but also Italy and Spain. And there was a photo I saw of a forklift putting coffins into a refrigerated truck in New York, and recognizing that they are facing hundreds of deaths a day. And there was a quote, and I just wanted to I think it's just so poignant. It says, personally, it's hard to go through this all day, and then it's hard to stay up all night watching those numbers come in and know that you're in charge of the ship at this time. And that was the governor of New York. And yeah, I think there's just something really distressing about what we're seeing in a short period of time.
So what sort of decisions are health professionals being asked to make about patient care under extraordinary conditions? Coming back to the questions I was asking earlier.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's hope that we don't get to that point here in New Zealand, but certainly in other jurisdictions at the moment, doctors are having to make choices between whose life they prioritise for saving. And, you know, that is such a divergence from the framework that clinicians generally work in, which is that they are motivated to serve the best interests of every patient that they have. So sometimes they will make decisions about withdrawing ventilation, but that would be based upon a judgment that they make, a clinical judgment about what serves the interests of that patient. So for them to have to be in a situation where they believe that there are multiple candidates whose best interests would be served by access to that care, but only one or only these ones can have it, that is a huge change from how they normally operate. And under that conception of a doctor's role obligation, where every patient matters to them, they're having to move very far away from that.
Mm. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? I was reflecting just last week about this very issue about how decisions are made to allocate scarce resources. And I was thinking, you know, sometimes in ethics, one of the things we do, particularly with students, is we present them with a hypothetical case or a vignette. And we say, imagine that you're in a situation like this. And then we would present them with some kind of scenario. And usually the scenarios are to illustrate a particular point that we're making, but they often entail situations that most of us will never probably have to encounter. And it struck me that, you know, we are in times at the moment where the kinds of scenarios that we've spoken to students about, what would you do in a situation where you had one ventilator and three patients who needed it to survive, how would you allocate that resource? And this has moved now from being a theoretical discussion to a very real one with very real consequences. And I think, as Monique just said, you know, our focus in ethics at a time like this has shifted from one that has focused really on promoting the well-being of individuals to thinking about how we maximise the greatest benefits for the greatest number of people. And that raises some very interesting and difficult questions around who ought to get these resources. And I think we're seeing that in other countries at the moment about their allocation.
Yeah. Well, there's been some really interesting sounding boards recently from the New England Journal of Medicine. So one of them is called The Toughest Triage, Allocating Ventilators in a Pandemic. Or the other one, Fair Allocation of Scarce Medical Resources in the Time of COVID-19. So what you say about physicians being asked to make decisions they never have really had to face before, many of them aren't prepared for the magnitude of this time. In New Zealand, what dilemmas might we expect our clinicians to face?
Well, one thing that I've been thinking through, which I see as being so essential in our context in New Zealand and not very well reflected in the international literature that's coming out about, for instance, prioritising access to ventilation, is how we serve the interests of populations who are likely to present with clinical considerations that will tend to block their access according to those utility-based criteria. So even where you feel like you're treating individuals fairly because you're applying the same requirements to each individual, you can be discriminating against a group who, for, you know, systemic reasons, might present with more comorbidities or present later in an illness, so they will score less well on the SOFA score measurements and things like that tend to be used. And in New Zealand, I think that has to be absolutely top of mind for us. How do we try and balance our obligations to groups in New Zealand as well as our obligations to individuals?
What are the implications of moral distress for clinicians, our patients, and the health system?
Look, I think the implications, you know, we shouldn't underestimate them. And like you say, there are different groups we need to consider. When you look at a lot of the evidence around moral distress and how it impacts health professionals, compassion fatigue is a huge one. Sometimes that can lead to emotional paralysis where people just feel unable to think clearly about what their responses should be. People may end up, in the worst case scenario, I guess, leaving the profession. The avoidance of responses to certain critical incidents. I think there's a range of things we need to be very careful about in terms of thinking about the implications of moral distress. And I guess one of the things I've been thinking about more recently is what it means for us as a society as well when we see our healthcare system under such pressures. And the ethical issues to me at the moment, at the heart of this, is around fairness and justice, but equally tied into that is the issue of trust. And of course, what we want is people to trust our healthcare system, that the kind of decisions that are being made on the ground, often in limited timeframes, often there isn't the luxury of being able to speak to people about situations, is that we lose trust. And so that is something that I think is really important for us to consider. And I guess that feeds into being transparent and as open as we can, being accountable for the decisions that are being made. And I think also being able to go back and revise decisions when greater evidence or better evidence comes to hand. So decisions around allocation might be put in place, but it's not to say that they're set in stone for the foreseeable future so that things can change. And I think where these kinds of decisions are made, they're much more likely to be accepted by teams, clinical teams and individuals in the public when you can see that that decision-making process has been a fair one.
It's interesting thinking about the ways that individuals' experiences of crises like this and societies, you know, how they mirror each other at the different levels, because, you know, I think we sometimes, you know, imagine how we will respond in a crisis situation, and we have a sense of how we want to be, what values we want to express through our actions, and we hope that we'll be able to do that, but of course we can't always. Sometimes the situations overwhelm us, and that can be a very distressing experience in itself, you know, the realization that the person who you hoped that you were, maybe you haven't been able to be faithful to that through your actions. And I'm wondering about how a similar phenomenon might present at a societal level. So, you know, as Philippa said, you know, we're moving in, or many countries, when they're thinking about how to do resource allocation in these contexts, are thinking the way that we normally do it, we can't do it like that. Because of this special context, we have to apply different principles. We're going to be governed by utility, by trying to save the most lives or the most life years. But if that deviates from the things that we hold dear as a society, the way that we express our collective personality and our values, that could leave us as very unclear about what we really care about as a society. You know, do we really value people in the way that we say that we do? And so it could leave us with some real work to do on what our values really are and whether we can step away from those when times get difficult.
One of the things that has been really heartening over the last couple of weeks is to see the seriousness with which Kiwis have got on board with the lockdown. You know, I think, yes, we hear about the exceptions of people doing silly things, but on the whole, Kiwis have knuckled down, stayed in their bubbles, done the right thing. And I think that speaks volumes about who we are as a people, actually, that, in fact, yes, it's inconvenient, yes, it's difficult, it's frustrating, it's really difficult for many families and individuals who, for whatever reason, have found themselves living in situations that, you know, they had to put up with because this happened very quickly. But people are doing it because they recognise the greater good here. And I think that's a real credit to us, actually, as a nation, and something that we should be really proud of. It's not to say that the concerns Monique has are not there. I absolutely think there will be a time when we need to look at, you know, what's happened and look at whether this has changed us. But it is really heartening to see that the values I think we hold as a nation are being expressed.
I wonder if that's tapped into who we are in terms of our own humanity and our altruism, and thinking about how we've been deeply moved by seeing physicians initially weeping in the hallways because of the choices they've had to make, and the angst of withdrawing support for reasons that actually aren't related to patient welfare. Just going back to our frontline workers, what is the risk in terms of, well, what are the risks in terms of psychological injury to them?
I think that the risks will speak to their professional identity, to their sense that they can be effective and ethical practitioners. It can lead to people, as Philippa has already indicated, distancing themselves physically from, you know, maybe wanting to leave the profession, but even staying in their role and feeling unable to connect emotionally, to feel empathy for their patients because it's too painful to feel like that continuously, and always be the bearer of bad news. And I think that some of the subspecialties and specialties who are at the most risk here, because they're going to have to be making those difficult decisions, at least in certain places, people like intensivists, they already have a big burden. They're already having to encounter families and patients who are in absolute crisis. You know, some of the worst situations those people are ever in, intensivists accompany them, walk with them, and have to help them through difficult decisions, and sometimes make difficult decisions for them. And that requirement, that burden, is going to be increased. So it's about the quality of what they're doing, but also the sheer quantity of it. And, you know, I think there's a limit to how much humans are able to emotionally engage with that, to feel it, to feel, move through it without being struck down by it personally.
Mm. I think the other dimension of this too is that, you know, these people who are at the front line have families themselves. They are at risk of transmitting and also being infected by this. So, you know, there is the professional obligations that they have, and often feeling distressed because they can't fulfil their obligations. But then there are their obligations, of course, to their families and their loved ones as well, and to themselves, to, you know, for their own well-being and their own self-care. So, you know, they really are extraordinary times. And I think, you know, this is such an important issue to be discussing. And I guess... You know, I want to sort of say I think we really should not be underestimating the severity of what this means for many people who are at the front line, and then thinking about what we need to do to respond, of course, to moral distress.
Well, maybe we can talk about how we can respond from an individual and systems and institutional level, because there are going to be complications of grief and deep trauma from these burdens that you talk about, which are emotional, spiritual, and existential.
One of the challenges, and that can, and it's a challenge that can provide a key at an individual level. But golly, I'm not very good at doing this, so you know, I think it's a hard ask. But you know, part of the challenge here is seeing the limit of your own capacity. And I mean, in principle-based deontological thinking, there's a principle that's often drawn on, which is ought implies can. And that principle is supposed to limit your exposure to blame. So the principle says you can only have an obligation to do something if it's possible for you to do it. So it's a very kind of common sense idea, but it's easy to lose a grip on that when you're in a situation where normally you can do this stuff, but you can't do it now. Holding on to that idea that you can't be obliged to do things that you cannot do, that you're not blameworthy for doing things that are actually impossible for you, and to try and experience, I guess, a kind of a humility, but also a self-compassion, you know, to think about how would you help another person who was experiencing this sense of being overwhelmed morally. You would try and guide them gently to the fact that they weren't responsible for creating the situation, and they could only take the actions that they did. And it doesn't make the distress go away. And it doesn't also preserve you from the blame of others, you know, family members, for instance, who may hold you responsible for the fact that this patient, their loved one, can't receive care. But it's one step in to trying to diffuse some of that distress.
Mm. And I think too, you know, this is where I think the importance of having colleagues and having teams where people are not necessarily making decisions on their own. And I know through some of the work that's been done in different parts of the world, and also in New Zealand, around the allocation of things like ventilators, is, you know, who is making that decision? Who are making those decisions? And, you know, a lot of the work that's been done that I've been looking at more recently has been, you know, proposing that the teams who look after patients on the floor, so to speak, on the ground, are not the people who are making these kind of high level decisions, so that there is a distancing, so that the people who are looking after patients actually can commit themselves totally to those patients and not feel a conflict of interest. And I think, you know, the teams supporting each other so that people are not feeling like they're making these decisions on their own. And, you know, I really love that word that Monique used, self-compassion, because I think that probably is something that many people are not particularly good at doing. Mm-hmm. But also I think, you know, for people who are also supporting teams, is to recognise the impact, I think, of things like moral distress and moral injury, and thinking about what it is to support people in a work environment, particularly around wellbeing. You know, I think this is something that we probably need to talk about more and more. And as is often the case, I think, in situations like this, you know, we learn incredible lessons after the fact. And I know earlier, Lil, you were talking about Waikare and some of the lessons that probably were learnt from White Island. And I wonder if some of those also are relevant here around that situation.
Well, there are certainly extraordinary and sustained demands on our healthcare workers and our health systems at the moment. I thank you both so much for joining me in exploring some of these issues. And thanks to our audience for listening.
Kia ora, Lil. Thank you.
Thanks, Lil.